ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with co-hosts Justin Darcy and Taylor Dyke.
Welcome to episode 19 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by Jimmy Unwalla's Avesta Bloodstock. Joining me today is co-host Taylor Dyke, along with our special guest Terry Henderson, founder of OTI Racing. Listeners will have seen the famous gold and navy blue hoops in the Melbourne Cup, the Cox Plate, the Caulfield Cup, the Arc de Triomphe, the Royal Ascot Carnival, and many more races all around the globe. We'll be asking Terry about his long career in the industry, some of his memorable moments on the track, and a recent hot topic, the Melbourne Cup veterinary protocols. Terry, welcome to the Business of Bloodstock.
Thanks, Justin.
So we'll kick things off. Working in the industry, you obviously have to have a love for the horse, and that would go for all career paths in the industry, whether that's media, syndication, training, or breeding. What was it that made you fall in love with the horse, Terry?
As a 10-year-old, a trotter called Dusty Miller, who used to go around the showgrounds with great aplomb, and I got to know his owner and breeder, and followed the horse for about 4 years between the ages of 10 and 14, and absolutely loved him. So he was the first introduction to horse racing, albeit harness racing.
Speaking of the harness racing, you were involved in a trotter early days, and he was your first horse that you owned, and subsequent to owning this horse with a friend of yours, you bought into Five Colts with Colin Hayes, and I read that you described it as you felt pretty hooked in terms of the ownership side of things early days. Can you describe for us your, I guess, early stages of ownership and, of course, getting involved in the racing side of things as well?
Well, that pacing was really the dominant part of my racing life early days. I did play golf with a guy who subsequently left me with half of a trotter who had a club foot. And I realised quite quickly that it really wasn't the way to enjoy the industry if you wanted success. So I started to buy some trotters in the mid-80s and then decided that I would increase the standard of the trotters I bought. And to do that, syndication was really just coming into Australia. There were a couple of companies around, and I formed a company called Paces Australia. And that gave me the access to buy a range of usually proven paces, and that was during the mid-80s. But at the same time, with a group of friends, we did buy five gallopers with Colin Hayes. So quite separately to the paces involvement, we developed a relationship with Colin, and we had some success there with a very good filly called Send Me an Angel, who won two group ones. So the racing and the trotting sort of ran parallel, albeit that the trotting side of it was in a business form through Paces Australia, and that grew very significantly in the 80s and really converted to galloping in the 90s. And then with the private side of it, well, that was almost ad hoc syndicates that I was involved in with other people.
Do you still have a love for the trotter and pacer and still follow the harness racing?
I certainly do. I don't have any harness racing horses at the moment, but I actually love the sport. Still got a lot of friends in harness racing. I have an enormous amount of respect for the horsemen in harness racing, horsemen and horsewomen, and certainly carnivals that we've just had, like the New Zealand Cup Carnival. I watch closely, and obviously quite a good friends, particularly the Purden family, still very heavily involved over in New Zealand, which, you know, we're our major trainers by the time I finished racing harness horses.
If we were to compare, say, the harness racing and horse racing and, I guess, the ownership side of things, do we see much syndication and that side of thing in harness racing these days at all?
There's a little bit. I suppose I'm a bit removed from it now. But it certainly in the days when Paces Australia was going, I think, you know, we were racing 40 or 50 paces, and I think Paces Australia won over 50 Group 1 races in its period, so it was quite a successful operation, and it was very visible in the industry. Nowadays, I think there are quite a number of syndicates, but a lot of trainers actually form their own syndicates, and that really is a basis of much of the ownership in harness racing. But as far as large syndication companies in harness racing, I actually don't know of any.
So obviously you and OTI own a lot of horses all around the globe. What do you feel would be the key differences between horse racing ownership in the UK and Europe versus ownership here in Australia and New Zealand?
Other than money. Look, it is very different. And they're both very appealing in their own ways. And, you know, and we've got a heavy involvement in England, Ireland and France. And even between those three, they're different. So it's sort of putting Europeans into one bag is probably a bit of a mistake. But look, the biggest single difference is the pervasiveness of racing in Australia. We're very lucky to have the general population, you know, interested in horse racing. Now, I know that might have changed a bit over the last decade or so with, you know, more emphasis in the social side of things generally, the social license side of things generally. But by and large, you don't get that same pervasiveness that we've just had with the Everest or the Melbourne Cup Carnival in the European countries. The Arc, for example, which is probably the biggest race in Europe, it attracts a lot of interest, but the man in the street doesn't know that it's on. The man in the street in Australia knows that the Melbourne Cup is on. And so that's probably the biggest interest, the biggest difference in terms of the broader aspect of the industry. But in terms of racing, there's no doubt that the quality of the European stock, particularly for horses at 1,600 metres upwards, is better than what we have here. And, you know, we see that in the results of the horses that come over from Europe and race here, particularly the ones that we and others buy to come over and race. Our sprinters certainly have an edge. And so in that sense, you know, our sprinters certainly are far more precocious here than they are in Europe. But, you know, we're blessed with an industry in Australia that by and large has a strong financial basis to it. And we need that because people need to have money coming back in to be able to pay their bills and buy the next horse. In Europe, so many of the bigger owners over there, really the prize money is quite secondary. They're able to run their racing businesses in such a way that they don't depend on their prize money. The trainers depend a lot on trading. So they're, you know, always open to look at selling horses. Whereas our guys, you know, the last thing they want is someone like us coming in asking if a horse wants to be, or can we buy a particular horse out of their stable? So, you know, our trainers rely on, you know, their fees, and now, you know, some of the most expensive trainers in the world in Australia, and the prize money percentages they get. Now, New Zealand's a bit of a hybrid because until recently, and things are certainly changing in New Zealand quite quickly over the last 12 months with the way that Ladbrokes have taken a position over there. But, you know, New Zealand's approach, their trainer's approach, was more akin to the Europeans where, you know, you can buy a horse out of a European, out of a New Zealand stable. But, you know, I think we are very, very fortunate in Australia to have this economic base to racing, which, you know, basically enables a lot more people to be involved in sport.
Do you find you have a strong uptake from Australian owners when you've obviously got your horses such as Docklands and the like who originally, or of course, still are trained overseas? Is there a strong uptake from your Australian database to race these horses overseas, obviously with the hope to one day bring them obviously back to Australia and Australasia?
With our owners, I think they're relatively savvy. I don't think they really care where the horse comes from. And as long as they can see the horse racing at some stage, and many of them do go to Europe to watch them race, but they like to see the horse be able to get to Australia, obviously. But I think, you know, if we, you know, in the last 2 weeks, we've bought horses based in New Zealand. There's one going into a big race this weekend. We've just bought a significant share in a horse that's been trained in Australia where the owner decided to sell and he'll stay with his existing trainer. Or, you know, we've got horses coming through from Europe all the time. I can't say that there's a huge difference in the popularity of one or another. What I can tell you is that it's usually easier to market a horse that's got very good quality and has already shown something. So, you know, people can see that they're going to almost envisage that horse being in a particular race and being successful in that race. It's easier to sell that sort of horse than to sell a yearling or indeed a weanling, where they've got to wait a lot longer and they really find it more difficult to envisage where that horse might be in 12 or 18 months' time.
For sure. OTI was formed in 1999 and has grown incredibly to become a world-renowned syndication. What do you enjoy most about syndicating horses out?
I've been around a long time and we've won a lot of races, as you know, but I really, really do enjoy the thrill that I see other people get from winning these big races. You know the old saying that you might only have 1% of a horse, but you've got 100% of the fun. It's not only true amongst the owners, but it's actually true amongst the people that run syndication companies, I think, because you get an enormous amount of joy out of seeing people get those results and a sense of achievement, because, you know, you're chasing horses from all around the place and you just love to see the horse come out and do what, you know, you put on paper that it might be able to do. And I think from that point of view, you know, the joy that you're seeing others get out of the game and the sense of achievement you get from yourself and that my staff get from here, you know, presenting a horse and, you know, having people really pleased with what they've been able to achieve with that horse is really fulfilling.
OTI is one of the largest syndications in the world, and it's incredible how well it's all maintained, given it's such a global setup. You've got, no doubt, thousands of owners. You've got trainers all around the globe. It must take a lot of people power to be able to sustain and continue this build that OTI seems to have.
Well, we got a terrific team here, and, you know, most organisations rely on a good team. I think our team's got a really client-focused culture. I think I'm the dumbest person in the business when it comes to IT, and I think that's very healthy, because we do have very capable young people here in that school. And I think we seem to work fairly well as a team. I think we've got Gus Boyd now in Sydney, so we've got a permanent person up there. And Shane, a general manager, well, he's worked his way through the ranks, and, you know, he's been with us now for 20 years, you know, is exceptionally capable on keeping information up to date. So, you know, I think it's just important to have a good team, you can't have people in our business that aren't interested in racing, so they're all dedicated racing people, but they're people with the sorts of skills you need in this modern era to keep track of the variables that we've got. And you're right, they're all over the place. They're in racing, they're in breeding, they're in, you know, seven or eight countries. And they're required to work very closely with, you know, racing stables and racing communication managers in stables, as well as, you know, pre-trainers, vets and adjustment facilities and so on. So I think we've got good systems. I think we've got very, very good systems, and I think that's at the heart of it, with good people.
Well, colours, we've been seen all over the world, and most importantly, winning all over the world. Is there been a favourite win that you've had with OTI?
That's a hard one. Well, of course, I was like with Paces Australia when we had the old business. We won the Melbourne Cup with the Paces Australia horse, that predated it. Look, there are some special wins, Talia, but some of them, funny enough, are not the races you'd think would be special wins. They're special for different reasons. Either a horse returning from an injury who's been able to excel. You know, Galo Shop, when he'd had two tendon operations, came back and won the Caulfield Stakes. You know, that was pretty special. And the Caulfield Stakes, a great race, a Group 1 race, but, you know, you think of that race. On that same time, we had, you know, we won another Group 1 race on the same day with Aloysia, and we'd run also the Herbert Power. So we had two Group 1 winners and a Group 2 winner all on the same day. So those race days are special. But, you know, you can go to Warrnambool, and, you know, I'll never forget Harbourview's first race start at Warrnambool. This is a horse that we had in a ready-to-run sale in Newmarket, where we were prepared to give him away for $3,000 or $4,000, because, you know, we didn't think he could run at all. And the vet happened to say, look, give him another 12 months, bring him to Australia. And I thought, pay for a horse that's worth $3,000 to come to Australia. And yet the joy that he brought Matty Williams and the team down there and the owners who got involved in him was incredible. And it just happens that Docklands happens to be his half-brother. So, you know, so that Warrnambool win with Harbour Views was quite special. But, of course, then you go to the, you know, the other end, and Manigar, you know, his streak of wins when Peter Moody got hold of him was exceptional. And, you know, I never forget the Tancred win at Rose Hill. You know, when Simon O'Donnell was involved in the business at the time, we just couldn't believe that this horse was was able to achieve those sorts of heights. So look, very hard to put a finger on one race.
And as you say there, it's all about that. A big part of it, especially for a syndicator, is getting the owners involved and having everyone experience the fun. And you mentioned before, whether you own a hair of the tail or you own the whole horse, at the end of the day, that person still owns whatever horse it is. And to give people that thrill of winning, it must be a feeling. It's just, yeah, it must be a feeling of like an accomplishment almost for yourself.
Well, it is. And, you know, we're quite friendly with the young guys that run, where they've got micro shares. My racehorse, and they're fantastic, passionate guys, and you know the people that buy, you know, a poofteenth of some of these big horses, and they're getting the same sort of thrill out of it. So that's again one of the great joys of racing in Australia, that it is accessible to people.
For sure, and the more people we have owning horses and interested in horses, the better it is for our sport in the long term. So it is really important.
Young people too, Talia too, I might add.
And, yes, that's it.
And that is an incredible part of particularly the micro share business. And indeed, we've got more young people coming in to own shares with OTI. So it's that part of it's great.
For sure. So back to OTI, in terms of the future, what does it look like for you guys? Is there more expansion in the works? Are you looking to maybe dive into colts and syndicates or standing stallions or anything like that?
I don't think we'll be standing stallions. I own a few stallion shares, but... No, I don't think we'll be going that far down. I think our breeding activity is really an adjunct to the racing. I think we'll be staying in racing. I think our business, with we touched on it before, with the young people coming through our business, they're the people that are going to run OTI in the future. You know, I'm in the twilight of my career in racing, and whilst I like to think that I've still got plenty of years to go, catering for the future for this business is all about looking after the young people and having them take more and more responsibility in the business. And that's happening. You know, our guys now travel a lot more than they used to. So, you know, they're getting more experience. So I think there'll be a period probably the next 3 or 4 years where we go through a bit of a transition as more power goes out to the staff, and then they'll direct the future from there. But I do think that in syndication generally, there's pluses and minuses. The big plus is that there are still so many other areas to go into with syndication. You know, I've spent a lot of time talking to the Europeans and the English and the French about syndication. I wouldn't be surprised if syndication actually entered Hong Kong at some stage, because, you know, they've got a lot of people in the Hong Kong Jockey Club that don't own horses, and that's what it was set up for. So, you know, there's plenty of areas to grow globally. I think also, though, that syndication companies are faced with more of a challenge in competing with trainers who syndicate, because they can take a link out of the whole chain by syndicating horses themselves. So if syndicators are going to survive while trainers are out there syndicating almost in competition with them, those syndicators need to have an edge. There needs to be some benefits you're getting from syndication companies that you might not get from a trainer. So that's the challenge. But I think, broadly speaking, OTI's role over the next few years was to keep the quality of our horses up, make sure our owners that we have are happy, and obviously welcome in new ones, but really just have that business very stable as it goes through a transition period, as I wind back a little and the younger guys take over.
I'll wind it back a little bit here with OTI. Obviously, your first 10 or 15 years, and he was one of my dad's favourite trainers, so I had to ask this question. And you worked very closely with the legend that is Luca Camani. You spoke about Galo Chop before. His daughter Francesca was in the horse, and now his son Matt is training here as well, who you have horses with too. It's the Camani family, and working with these guys have obviously been a massive part of OTI's history as well.
Oh, look, we owe a lot to the Camanis. You know, it was Sarah Camani who actually legged us into Bauer as a result of me trying to buy another horse. And she said, don't buy that, you should be buying this. So, you know, we owe a lot to them. But the relationship that was developed with Lucas Stable was such that it took us into the Newmarket area in, you know, a reasonable way. And then that sort of branched out into France and Ireland. So whilst we'd had international horses before we had this relationship with Luca, it was Luca's link that enabled us to grow so much more and indeed appreciate what Europe had to offer so much more. And Luca's a very clear, Luca can be a professor at a university. He's a very intelligent guy, and he knew more about racing than just how to train a horse. And for us to be able to access, that sort of intelligence was, for me personally, very, very beneficial. Besides the fun that we had along the way, and there was plenty of that with the winners that we had. Unfortunately, we didn't win a Melbourne Cup with him, but that would have been, that probably would have made your favourite race horse win if that had have happened.
Yeah, we'll definitely touch on Bauer very shortly. Obviously, he went very, very close in 2007 against Vue. But yeah, we'll touch on that one shortly. But nonetheless, one thing I found out when I did a bit of research on you, Terry, is that you're actually an author and you wrote a book called See How We Run. What inspired this, and tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I'm a transport economist by qualification. I haven't always been in the horse business, and had a lovely business which was quite successful, and it sold to an international company back in the mid-90s, which gave me more time to do things that made less money. And so as a result of the sale of that business, I had a little bit more time on the hands, and there was a lot of, the time we sold the business was a large business with a lot of pressure. And I decided to do a few things that were a little bit outside of the business environment. And one of them was to write a couple of books, and another was to do a lot more adventure travel. But I've always been a runner, I'd always, in my business, travel around the world, and I'd always go for a run at 5 o'clock in the morning, usually if you're jet lagged or whatever. And so I got to know a lot of the cities before they woke up or as they woke up. So I thought there'd be a market for a book like that, that basically had a map of each of these cities and how to go around having either a short run, a 5K run or a 10K run around these cities, because I knew the cities fairly well. So I spent quite a few months researching them and had a professional photographer then go around and take shots. And I was in the end very, very proud of the product that we produced. We had this lovely coffee table book and it sold very well, and it was a sense of joy to be able to do that, and almost a bit of therapy coming out of mainstream business.
For anyone who might be looking to actually purchase this book, is that still available to buy somewhere?
I think it is on Amazon. Someone asked me the other day. I think I've only got about 30 or 40 copies left, but I have seen it around, and but it's also now over 20 years old, so there are probably better ways to get around cities than what I did. But I you talk about having criticism. I had so many people write to me and say, look, you should have gone this way and not that way when you did your run. It was a book that promoted a lot of discussion.
That is brilliant. Well, we'll talk a little bit now about the Melbourne Cup, a race that OTI has been very prevalent in across the last 20-odd years. And obviously the protocols have been introduced in the last couple of years, and it has been quite a hot topic, especially in the last month. We haven't had any international fatalities since 2020, and obviously these protocols have been a big part as to why that stat may now exist. But of course, it has created plenty of hysteria, with scans seemingly showing issues that aren't prevalent to the eye as such. But you've had runners from overseas compete in the great race, as well as some locally trained horses as well. It's a two-part question here, but would you be able to walk us through both the difference between how locals take their place in a cup compared to an international? And then secondly, just a comment on your views as to where the protocols currently sit.
Yeah. On the international horses, the protocols are required and they've been shown to be successful. I think whilst it's expensive to bring a horse over from Europe, the reality is it costs the industry an enormous amount of money over and above, what might be provided by the owner, as it were, or people like OTI to bring those horses over. So you can justify why they do these pre-tests to see whether a horse is capable of travelling over or not. Now, most of those tests in the past have required horses to do MRIs. And they're not what you might call final tests. They're basically tests that enable the horse to take its part in getting onto a plane to come to Australia or going to quarantine. There are x-rays done and there are, you know, trot-ups and a series of other tests. So they get to a stage where they're approved to travel, because if there's not much good putting them on a plane and spending all this money from the industry's point of view and then, and the owner's point of view for that matter, and then find that they can't arrive here. Arrive here and then be in a position to race. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that the horses once here, this is the international horses, are then subject to basically scrutiny all the way along the line. You know, they're trotted up every couple of days, and you know, you've got all sorts of minor issues that pop up as a result of that, and some are significant, and some, you know, as we've seen this year, stop horses from progressing. Now, when they get here, these horses, as do the local horses, they have to have a CT scan. And the CT scan is different from an MRI because the CT scan is effectively a three-dimensional X-ray. And that'll show up issues that wouldn't have been shown up by an MRI. So the first thing is that perhaps what should have happened and what may happen in the future is that instead of these horses having one sort of tests in Europe and another sort of test when they get here, they should be having the CT scans over in Europe and maybe even an MRI as well. And that way, at least it'll take out a lot of that angst that the internationals have when they get out here and find that they've got to do another test other than an MRI. These protocols will continually be refined, and I think you know, that's for the better of not only the frustration that many connections feel when their horses are taken out of the race, but also for the quality of the horses that actually are left in the race. I think what came out of the scratching of a horse like Athabascan last week is that there is also a great need to improve the communication and the level of feedback that connections get when horses have to be withdrawn from the race. And I think that's generally been acknowledged by Racing Victoria particularly. And I think that what we'll see is a different approach to communicating with connections the issues that may cause a horse to be taken out of the race. And if that's accompanied then with the right sort of advice, and we've certainly had it since Athabascan was scratched last week, on how to get that horse back into acceptable condition to race, well, you know, that's very welcome. One of the criticisms of many connections in the past has been just a simple lack of information that's been available on why their horse was taken out of the race, and indeed what they then had to do to rectify the situation. But I think we're working on that, and I think and that'll come to pass.
OTI obviously had a runner in the Cup this year. Sea King, trained by Harry Eustace, came over, won the Bendigo Cup in fine fashion, and then raced a week later in the Melbourne Cup. What is the biggest challenge in the last few years for you as an owner to get the horse over here for the Cup?
I suppose identifying a horse that's going to be able to cope with, you know, a variety of variables. We'd only owned Sea King for about 8 weeks. In fact, he was bought partly as a travelling companion for Docklands. So it's one of those situations where, you know, he ended up making more money than Docklands did during the campaign. But look, it's, if you've got the right horse, the processes are pretty good. Certainly from our point of view, the facilities at Werribee were excellent. They were very well looked after. We had no complaints whatsoever. I think maybe some people are very quick to blame facilities when things might not go their way, but our experience generally with Werribee has been a very positive one. I think one of the biggest challenges we had, quite frankly, Talia, was getting someone to ride the horse at the 50 kilos, because, you know, I've got a bit of difficulty seeing why we've got all these top jockeys sitting on their backsides on Melbourne Cup Day, because the weights are as they are. While, you know, we're running around the country and internationally trying to find jockeys who can ride at these low weights. I think one of the issues that we should be addressing in future is to raise the weights to a level where you'll keep the same variance between horses, but be able to introduce weights that are capable of, or where there are more jockeys available to ride. But it seemed a bit silly when we had so many of our jockeys down on minimum weights this year when our good jockeys were sitting on their bum.
For sure. I wanted to ask a little bit about your early life. So Justin and I are both Gippsland born and raised. And a couple of years ago, you mentioned to Justin that you are as well, raised in the small town of Bourne North, which is just not far from here. You're now a world-renowned figure in the racing industry. Do you ever get any time to head back to Gippsland?
Oh, but yes, I go down there a lot. A favourite auntie who's in a nursing home in Maule. And, in fact, I was supposed to go down there the Monday between before Melbourne Cup Day because he wasn't all that well. But she's down there. So I was down there about 3 weeks ago to see her and caught up with some cousins. But yes, you know, you don't forget your roots. I was actually born in Yarlorn, which no longer exists, as many people might know, because I converted into a coal mine and then lived in Morwell and Yarlorn North until we came to Melbourne when I was in my early teens. But, so I do get down there a lot.
That's good to hear you get back to the grassroots anyway. Yeah, it's a beautiful place, Gippsland, and I think obviously we've got some good racing, good tracks down here as well, and definitely a part of the world that I think people need to get out and explore as well.
I played a few games of footy down at Woodside down in South Gippsland, which is rugged stuff.
Yeah, they're tough boys, the old Woodside boys. I remember playing a couple of games. My first ever senior game was against them, and they certainly belted me around. So they're a good crew there.
My memory down there is that I owned a property down at Woodside and was trying to avoid falling over on the sheep shit on the Woodside Oval because that was a way of keeping the grass down. And, of course, the sheep weren't necessarily – they didn't hear that you might have footballers running and falling over what they'd done.
Oh, that's brilliant. They've definitely changed it around a bit these days now, that's for sure. Well, I'll quickly get back to OTI here. So in 2019, you began the equine welfare program that sees the business track the whereabouts and updates on horses that were previously raced by OTI. Can you tell us about how this started and how important it is for thoroughbred care and certainly a really strong industry initiative?
Yeah, it is something that we're incredibly proud of because it's worked, and it frustrates me that some sections of our industry haven't been more proactive in this area. Fundamentally, we felt that welfare was driven around two things. One is being able to track a horse once it had retired, and secondly, to have the money then to make sure that that horse was looked after if it needed assistance. And we introduced one of the young guys who's still here now, he created a welfare program, which I think is still state of the art, where we track all the horses that retire. We make an agreement with people that buy our horses, even if they're bought to race, we still track them through that until the day that they retire. And then we let the people know that if that horse needs some assistance, that we have funds there to help them out. We applied a levy on each horse that we sold back in 2019, and that quickly built up to reasonable sorts of funds. And so we've got in our balance sheet, as it were, we've got a horse welfare provision with money in it that enables people who have horses that we won't trace to call on us if they find themselves where they need some help. If you go onto our website, you can actually see all the horses that we've retired since and where they are and what they're doing, whether they're, you know, ponies for kids or whether they're, you know, hacks or whether they're nannies, stud farms, they're all there. So we're very, very proud of it, and we've got someone that spends about half her week now just controlling that welfare aspect. I still can't believe that we don't have chips in horses so that we can locate them once they're retired. It's so easy to do from a technological point of view. And I think the industry is very exposed to criticism should things go wrong, that we certainly hope don't happen. But if things go wrong and we can't identify that this horse is over there and we can put our hands on it and go and see it if we need to and take care of it. So we've still got a long way to go, but I think I just wish, rather than just concentrate on the pre-training or what Sydney are doing, putting them all in the paddock, they just get more focused on locating a horse and making sure we've got someone there who is making sure that that horse is in good health.
It's an important part of the industry going forward, and something that's certainly looked upon by not only people in the industry but also those outside of the industry as to how we take care of our horses, both while they're in their racing career and post-career as well. So it's fantastic to see OTI taking that next step and doing what you guys are doing. It's special to see.
Yeah, no, as I say, we're really proud of it. And the two people that have been involved in it since we set it up here have done a terrific job. And look, I think as an industry, we know that we're going to have darts thrown at us from various quarters and the nature of what we do in racing horses. And I fail to see why we're not even more proactive in that area. And I don't think we need more money. I think we've got plenty of money coming through the system to be able to do it. It just needs to concentrate on those two major things, making sure we know where these horses are and making sure that their health is kept up to scratch.
I'm going to go through some horses now that have been a big part of OTI. If you could just be able to tell us a little bit about what all of these horses meant to OTI, and certainly they've all shaped how the business is seen today too. We'll kick off with, I said before, 2007 Melbourne Cup runner-up, but 2008, and it was Bower. He was a special little horse for you guys.
Yeah, well, he was. You know, he wasn't a big horse. He came out here as a second stringer for Luca. There was a horse called Mad Rush, I think, actually started favourite at the Melbourne Cup that year and ran fourth in the Caulfield Cup. Bower won his way through the Melbourne Cup with when he won the Geelong Cup with Francesca Camani strapping him. And then, you know, I think he started at 35-1 in the Melbourne Cup and just dipped out. But he was a very special horse, and he was at the start of what you might call a large growth in numbers of horses coming from Europe for OTI.
This horse was my favourite racehorse of all time, so I can't wait to hear you talk a little bit about him. And you mentioned him before, and that horse is Manigar.
Yeah, well, Manigar, he wasn't the prettiest grey that you would ever think. He had a funny-shaped body. He was a quirky horse by nature. He was an Aga Khan horse. We tried to buy him 3 months before we actually secured the deal. And he went across to Luca Camani with a proviso that he was never allowed to start in France again because they didn't want to embarrass the French connections that had been involved with him. He ran very well for Luca. The amazing thing about Manigar was that while he was with Luca and indeed with the Aga Khan, he'd never started under 2,400 metres. So when we eventually, on his second trip to Australia, decided to leave him here and went to Peter Moody, Pete was able to put some speed into the horse's legs, and he won, I think, a Group 3 first up over a mile, and then obviously went on to win at 2,000 metres and 2,400 metres at Group 1 level. But look, a terrific horse, a lovely horse to be involved with. He's not one you'd want in your backyard as a pet because he was a little bit full of himself, he was just a legitimate racehorse. And he then left Australia and he went to America to become a show jumper, and he was absolutely useless at that. But one of our owners was keen to take him over there and try him out, and had him penciled as a future Olympian in the show jumping, but that wasn't his go. But he only died recently, actually, the old Manigar, but lovely horse.
He certainly was. Now one of my favourites, a horse who captivated audiences and arguably taken before we saw the best of him, and that's Thunderstruck.
Yeah, well, you know, Thunderstruck was a very, very special horse and probably the best horse that we've bought out of New Zealand other than, you know, going back to Doremus. And it was a funny purchase because we've used the same agent in New Zealand for many years, Phil Cataldo. And Phil has done a fantastic job for us. And Phil rang me up about this horse and I said, what was he worth? And they said the figure, and I said, well, we'll pay that. So Phil agreed to pay it. And then he rang me back and he said, oh, young Michael Kent's just knocked you off with a higher figure. I said, oh, the little bugger, you know. So I had to ring Michael up and say, thanks very much. But we joined forces and got a cup. Michael and Mick Price got some people involved, and he became a lovely horse for us. But we didn't see the best of him. You know, he had that rock star personality in all respects. A big, strong horse, powerful, and just a great horse to be around. And I think Jamie Carr probably still rates him as one of the most impressive horses she's ever sat on.
This horse, certainly, we saw the best of, and he was a triple Group 1 winner for you guys. We, again, spoke about him just before, and that's Galo Chop.
No, well, he took our owners all around the world. He went to Dubai, he went to Hong Kong, he raced in England at the Royal Ascot meeting, obviously in France. He didn't go to Qatar. He got an invitation to Qatar when they were just starting up, and we didn't go. But and then he came down to Australia, went to Perth. So he gave our owners a tremendous experience of racing around the world. And you know, he came across here for the Cox Plate in as a 5 year old, and he ran sixth in the Cox Plate, and then won the McKinnon on the following Saturday, and we had a trainer who couldn't speak any English. He'd never experienced anything. This Galashot was trained in France alongside a jet range, so when you went to inspect the horse, we could not believe it when we first went down there to buy him, that these noises were happening and these horses were completely impervious to it. So you know, he could put up with anything, old Galo, and so we got him out here. And his trainer then had the experience of putting up with the hordes of people on Melbourne Cup Week when he'd won, and he couldn't speak a word of English. So the poor guy, Anton de Vontrick, his name, is a great guy. Found it very, very difficult. But a range of experiences go with Galo. This is even before he went to Weary and then on to Matt Williams, that gave our owners tremendous joy.
The second last horse we'll talk about here, he's arguably one of the banner horses at the moment in Australia for OTI. He won a Queensland Derby by a monstrous 10 lengths, and that's Warmonger.
Yes, yeah, well, Warmonger, again, came out of New Zealand, and he was another horse that we were able to buy with a prize kit, and he came as what we thought a promising staying type. Interesting thing, he had his first race up at Seymour, and I went up to have a look at it. Froggy knew it jumped, I think he went third or fourth, and Froggy knew it jumped off, and he said, this horse could win a Derby. So he was very, very insightful in his comment, because the horse did. And then after the Queensland Derby, which was incredibly impressive, of course, I would have been quite happy to see the horse in the paddock. Mick wanted to give him a couple of runs to see if he could stand up for the Caulfield Cup. He was hooked after the Caulfield Cup, and rightly, Mick gave him a spell, and we'll probably give him a light autumn and get him ready for next year's Melbourne Cup.
And of course, it would be remiss of me not to ask about the enigma, Tom Melbourne.
Tom, you could write a book on, of course, because everything that could go wrong went wrong, other than when we bought him. I know I was in Newmarket Broodmare Sale with Hubie de Burg, a great friend of OTI. And Hubie said, there's a horse running in Ireland that we've got to keep an eye on tonight. This is a Dundalk, which is, as you can imagine, by December, it's bloody cold and it's wet and it's dark. And of course, Tom won. I think by 11 o'clock that night, we'd been talking to the guy who trains on the border between North and South Ireland. And anyway, Hubie had a deal done, I think, late that night after the races. Needless to say, Bob, the news that got back to Australia the next day that this horse had won so impressively, we could have made good money by selling him without even doing anything. But, of course, we bought him out here, and then, you know, he had a sort of stop-start early career. He won the Albury Cup in unbelievable fashion, running down the outside rail with Bossy on board. Then we sort of went into no-man's land for a little while. We couldn't work out whether he was a 1,400-metre runner or a Melbourne Cup runner. He just confused us at every point, and finally got to Chris Wallace, and of course then started to put these run of seconds together and develop his reputation. And all the owners through that horse had a fantastic time. They enjoyed, and of course the more we ran second, it was almost just as enjoyable as winning in the race, because it's just what we expected. But he I think someone worked out once that if he had have won the races that he ran second in, he would have won well over 20 million, as distinct from the three or so that he won. But a great, great horse, and out at Living Legends now, and they love him out there. So he's enjoying the good life.
How did Tom get his name, by the way?
There's the guy who had him, can't think of his name, in Ireland. This horse was by Fiorente, he was closely related to Fiorente. And of course, Fiorente had just won the Melbourne Cup. And he knew that if they called a horse Tom Melbourne, people would link him with Fiorente. And he'd have so much more appeal than if it was called some vague name. So it was a strategic ploy by the guy in Ireland to gain the attention of Australian buyers by giving him that name with a connection with Fiorente. And he could have caught plenty on the way that Tom ran, because he was very impressive in that first race start. But that's how we got involved. So he was actually named in Ireland Tom Melbourne. It was nothing to do with us in Australia.
There you go. Who is the one horse for OTR to watch for 2025 that punters and racing lovers should keep an eye on?
Well, until he had a tendon injury recently, I probably would have said Mark Twain, because he was very, very impressive winning the Roy Higgins, and probably, you know, we grit our teeth on the fact that he wasn't in the Melbourne Cup because he had an automatic entry. If he comes out of his tendon injury, he's certainly a very, very exciting horse. But look, there are a number around. There's a horse that recently had a start called Noble Steed, who was a horse with the Freedmans. I think looks a very exciting stayer going forward. Phil Stokes has just got one in from Ireland that was trained by Joseph called Deacon. He looks a very exciting stayer. I think he's certainly capable of getting through to Melbourne Cup level. On the younger brigade, the horse that we bought off the Aga Khan this year called Saganti and ran a nice race in the Rose Hill Cup. I think he's a very, very talented horse, and, you know, he could well develop into a Cox Plate mile and a half horse, you know, next spring. So there are quite a few around, as there always are in a business like us, that you're excited about their future. So there's a Wooten Bassett that we actually bred that we really like. I don't know if we've got a name for him yet, but he's out of, again, Fiorente's family, out of a mare called Balia. And again, he could develop into a really, or she could develop into a really nice filly. She's certainly got the breeding to do it in early days. She looks quite special. But we're not likely to be producing Golden Slipper winners. You know, I think Lady Laguna was probably our only horse that ever made it to the Golden Slipper, and it's generally not the sort of horses that we've been chasing.
That's the beauty of it. You don't necessarily have to chase those horses, because the setup that you guys have at the moment and that you have had, it's been incredibly successful. So, yeah, that makes complete sense. But we'll just finish up here, Terry, with our last segment. It's called Fast Five, where we'll just throw five questions at you just to get to know you a little bit more. Taylor, you kick us off.
What is the best racetrack that you've attended around the world, Terry?
A long shot.
And what is one race in the world that you'd love to win that OTI haven't as of yet?
Yeah, same connection with long shot.
Do you prefer the Royal Ascot Carnival or the Melbourne Cup Carnival?
That's, you know, so which do you like the most? They're both equally enjoyable, very for different reasons, but I love both, and especially off the back of the carnivals in both places that we had this year. They're both absolutely incredible.
Do you prefer to race colts and geldings or fillies and mares?
Doesn't matter, really. Nature of our business tends to favour, obviously, the colts and geldings, because going horses are usually geldings or colts. But, you know, we've had numerous Group 1 filly winners, and they're always extra special, because it gives the owner such a good return when they retire.
And what is one piece of advice you'd give to someone looking to buy into their first racehorse?
If you've got $10,000 to buy a racehorse, buy shares in two at $5,000 each. In other words, spread your risk. It's a fickle game, and with all the goodwill in the world, you know, you can't design success. But I think if you're in a situation where you've got a little bit of money, if you can spread it around a bit, you're going to get that success. And once you've got it in one, you know, the fact that the other might not have been so successful, you won't remember that.
Terry, thank you so much for coming on and joining us on the Business of Bloodstock. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing all about you, the history of OTI, and yes, the horses you've had, and of course the equine welfare program that you guys have as well. And yeah, we wish you all the best for 2025 and the remainder of the year. And yeah, again, thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure, guys.